Now for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
A number of years ago, my district manager at the time asked me to do a little research on salesmanship, and he gave me carte blanche to go to the bookstore, buy any books that I wanted to buy on salesmanship, and the purpose for it was that he would give me an hour to present at a district meeting that we would have to my fellow representatives. Some of the things that I'd learned, we go to sales school, and some of you have been involved in some of these things. When we are sent in our business to school, it was not only scientific, but it was also inclusive of how to approach the customer and, you know, those sorts of things. So it's kind of a never-ending kind of training, because you don't just go through training one time and then just remember everything there is to remember. So some of the techniques and some of the ways in which you approach people, I really felt as though you have to be yourself. You can't just, you know, paint by the numbers, and everybody is like the yellow pencil, number two pencil, and they're going out into the world. Our business attracted all kinds of different people, all kinds of different disciplines, and, you know, quite honestly, as long as you had a college education and a degree and you met a certain criteria, then the major could have been in engineering, it could have been in health sciences, it could have been in sociology, and it's not necessary for everybody to have exactly the same background, is my point. But we always need continual training. So my boss was really good. He kind of gave me a blank check to read as many books and cull as much information and, you know, develop it into a training for our specific district, which I did, and I enjoyed doing that. One of the books that I had on sales training kind of made me laugh, because it was written by a sales manager who was an insurance salesman. And this is kind of a family thing, a family joke. This actually was his technique in hiring a new person into his company. The first thing he would do after hiring a brand new sales rep in insurance sales was he would drive that person. He details this, and it was so funny to read it, because I'm thinking, what would I do if I were in this situation? First thing, seriously, that he did was drive the new salesperson down to the Cadillac dealership. And the guy would look around and say, well, what are we doing here? He says, you're going to go in. I know the sales manager. You're going to buy a brand new Cadillac. I can't afford a brand new Cadillac. Oh, yes, you can. Oh, yes, you can. What am I going to tell my wife when I get home? You're going to tell her you just got a brand new car. And that's how the story went. The idea being that if the salesperson had to buy a brand new Cadillac, then if he was forced to, as a condition of his employment, to buy a brand new, and Cadillacs are not cheap, right? I don't own a Cadillac. I know people who own Cadillacs. They're not, I mean, even though they may be marginally better than a Ford or a Chevy or a Pontiac, well, I guess there are no Pontiacs. Anyway, so even though they have the cachet of being very expensive, right? And this book was probably written 20 years ago and maybe 30 years ago. I don't know. But if the idea was that if you're forced to buy a brand new Cadillac and have this huge payment every month, then you're going to be really motivated to get out there and sell. And so he would detail how, you know, most of the time they drive up to, okay, now we're going to take this brand new Cadillac and we're going to show it off to your wife. The wife comes out, what did you do? We can't afford that. Honey, yes, we can. The sales manager patiently explained, you know, your husband is going to be much more motivated to be successful now. And this was a thing. And I thought it was really funny. I thought it was hugely funny, because and I passed it on to my sons, the story, and we probably talked about it at dinner time, right? And we talked about this a couple times when they were growing up. And I thought it was a little bit funny. We have kind of a family joke. It's kind of a family joke. kind of a family tradition that has been passed down from my father to me and then to my sons. My dad was big on not letting up, not giving up, not letting up, always moving forward, forward, forward. And it probably had a lot to do with him growing up during the Depression and realizing there was, you could never take a breath and feel easy about yourself or your future because you were one step from not having anything to eat. And during high school, he held down 3 part-time jobs because his father was out of work. And he was work all the time. And it was always this constant pressure of having to produce. And it kind of bred in our father that in virtually everything that he did, he was super competitive. Even with us as boys, and Hugh will remember this. I mean, our dad never let us win. I mean, when we were kids, you know, sometimes dad, oh, I'll let him win a point here, there. Not dad. He would slap us down. Now, it wasn't everything that was always competitive, but there were a few things in our household that were competitive. Basketball was one, and ping pong was one. And I mean, we're young and we're just learning how to play ping pong. And as we got older, we'd have some epic matches. But dad would never give an inch. And he was not the kind that would say, you know what, to encourage my sons a little bit, I'll just give them a point here. No, it was dogged and determined and it was competitive. And also in golf, it was like, I remember playing one time when I was like 16 or 17, I was getting pretty good at golf and I got to be really good. And dad was a pretty good player too, but there got to be the point to where I could hit the ball a little bit further than he could. And that just made dad get more and more competitive. And he wasn't above getting in your head a little bit. You know, it was like for a golfer, and it was every stroke counted. And that's the one thing that dad was really good at. He was good about teaching us to really count every stroke. And, you know, what'd you get on that hole? Oh, are you sure? You know, did you count that penalty that you got? Because dad wanted to win and he wanted to beat us. He never wanted to lose to us. He never wanted to lose. And I remember one time I had a putt that was probably about this length. And that length in golf is kind of the length that you should make it every time, but sometimes you don't. And so I remember I had a putt and I was ready to putt and dad said, and in golf, for those of you that are non-golfers, if you have what we call a gimme, one that everybody could make 100% under the circumstances, then to speed up the game, if it's just a casual match, you just say, hey, that's good, pick it up. And, you know, with my dad, if it was like that far from the hole, then he would say, pick it up. But if you had one that most of the time you could make without any problem, but maybe if you're under pressure in a tournament, you know, okay, you're going to have to putt that. And I've been in tournaments where, okay, your opponent in match play doesn't let you just pick that up. But with my dad, I'm thinking, you know, dad's going to be, you know, dad said, can you make it? And I said, yeah. He says, well, then make it. Which puts a whole lot of other pressure. And I took that tradition to my sons and we built, you can still see it. You can drive up north on Houghton Road and the second street before you get to Snyder. There's a basketball court that we built at the house that we were renting. And when the boys were like 11, 12, we had some epic battles because I would play Stephen and James 2-on-1. And, you know, I mean, when they were that age, I could beat them pretty handily. I mean, they were little, you know, and I was towering over them. But as they got into the 14 and 15 age group, then 2-on-1 was exhausting for dad. And that's when I decided to hang up the sneakers, because when Steven could block my shot from 15, 20 feet from the basket, and I didn't know he could jump that high, I said, okay, time to go in. We'll let these two boys play on them, because I didn't like to lose either. And I, you know, was kind of like my dad. So because of this, there is kind of a spiritual lesson I want to not just tell family stories. Dad was big on complacency. He hated complacency. He hated just resting on your laurels. And that is one of the things that we have kind of taken into our family about, you know, and kind of made a joke with it, that I've told the boys, don't rest on your laurels. And whenever they brought some achievement to me, you know, like my dad, and I was doing a little bit more kiddingly than my dad, but I would say, don't get complacent. Don't get complacent. So that thing about complacency, he passed down to us. I passed down to my sons, don't get complacent. So a few years ago, my son, my middle son, James, was working for a local company, and he had a company car, and he left that position for another job. So he had a day when he had to turn in his car, and he had to clear out his office. And so it was on the west side of town, west of Oracle. And so he asked me to pick him up there and give him a ride home. And he, you know, I knew he was starting a new job, new career, and all this kind of stuff. So I picked him up, and we got in the car. Kind of as a joke, I drove him over to the, we were right next to the auto mall. And I just, he didn't know what I was doing, you know, because it was a way that you could get home. But I drove right to the Cadillac dealership at the auto mall, and I started parking the car. And he says, what are you doing? I said, you get out and you march up there and you buy yourself a brand new Cadillac. And then I was joking. I said, but don't get complacent. Anyway, one of the most important warnings in the Bible is actually about spiritual complacency. Turn to the book of Proverbs in chapter 1. Proverbs 1 and verse 32. Now, before I began preparing for the sermon, I didn't have the idea that complacency was even in the, I knew the principle was in the Bible. I didn't know the word was in the Bible, because who knows how words are going to be translated from Hebrew or Greek into English, but it actually occurs. It only occurs a handful of times, but not enough to build a sermon around for a word search or anything like that. But it does mention complacency in verse 32 of Proverbs 1. It says, "For the turning away of the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them," which I think that's a good bit of wisdom there, and that's very, very true. Turn to the book of Zephaniah, chapter 1 and verse 12. There's only a handful of scriptures that mentions complacent or complacency, but there's a whole lot of information about the idea of spiritually complacent and being spiritually complacent, and we don't want to be in that particular firmament. In Zephaniah 1 and verse 12, and I kind of relate this to my dad, because he knew to be complacent in life was to be a failure, and to rest on your laurels was to fail at something, because you weren't trying to improve. You weren't trying to increase. You weren't trying to put your best foot forward. You weren't giving it your best effort all the time. And I suppose if there's any of life lessons that he taught us, that's probably primary. And I think it's a good life lesson, and it's one that can be applied in a spiritual way. Zephaniah 1 and verse 12, it says, "And it shall come to pass at the time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps and punish the men who are settled in complacency, who say in their heart, the Lord will not do good, nor will he do evil." Well, I'm not going to extract anything prophetic out of those verses, Proverbs or Zephaniah or anything, just trying to make the point that complacency is in the Bible and the warnings against complacency are there. My purpose as your minister today, here is my purpose. I want to drop you off at the Cadillac dealership after this is over. And you can either go in and buy a brand new Cadillac and thus be motivated in a spiritual way, or you can walk home. But it's not within walking distance. In fact, home is thousands of miles away, and there's no Uber, there's no transportation otherwise. So you either go into the Cadillac dealership and you buy yourself a Cadillac, or you just sit there and stay complacent. Because that's what it's coming down to. Okay? So who's up for riding in a brand new Cadillac afterwards? Yeah, all right. That's the kind of response I like. It's going to cost you. It's going to cost you. I should say, for the benefit of some, how about a brand new Dodge? Okay, all right. I know you. 900 horsepower. You know what's better than 900 horsepower? 1,000 horsepower. It's going to cost you. If you don't like the analogy, I'm sorry. I could scare you. I really could. I could give a fire and brimstone sermon on complacency. I don't think that's effective in the long run. I think maybe using a little bit of humor sometimes is helpful in the mix. But you need to fight spiritual complacency. You need to fight spiritual complacency. So either get a Cadillac or get out. You can't be a member of this church if you're going to drive a Yugo. Or a hybrid. Nobody has a hybrid, do they? Hybrids. How dumb is that? It costs more energy, and it pollutes the environment more to drive a clean energy car. Okay, I'm not going to go into it. I won't get into it. Fight spiritual complacency. 2 points today on fighting spiritual complacency. The title is Fight Spiritual Complacency, but I'm going to make this as simple as I possibly can, that even maybe a week from now, I'll be able to remember the 2 points that I gave you. Turn to 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1. 1 John 4, 1. This is a requirement. This is part of signing the fine print when you have to get the financing and have to get it titled and all that sort of thing. 1 John 4 and verse 1, point 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. The first point is test. You know, just kind of like you would test drive the car before you actually bought it. You wouldn't necessarily. Now, I have done that. I have bought a car without even driving it. The last car that I bought without even driving it. But I had had 6 of the exact same model cars through the years, so I had a pretty good idea of whether or not that car was going to perform, and it had a warranty. So I have a Fusion. I had 6 Fusions before, all company cars. They all drove about the same, so I did test it. This one I didn't. The salesman said, do you want to test drive it? It had like 70 miles on it because I bought it off the lot. And I said, no, I don't want to put any more miles on it. I'll just take it the way it is. So that's the way it happened. But we are to test. And you are in an environment now in which you as a Christian are required to test many things. We'll get into that. In Romans chapter 13, this is one area. This is one area in which you really, really need to be on your guard and test. Believe me, in the environment. As a Christian living in the world, because you're not separated from the world. Okay, you're not talking about church now, Mr. Buchanan. No, yeah, I am. I'm talking about your step into the world after you buy a Cadillac. You've got to buy a Cadillac. Romans chapter 13 and verse 1. I believe that some have entirely misinterpreted this instruction in this verse and several others. I don't want you to misinterpret it. And if you're going to live in this world and drive a brand new Cadillac, then you need to understand exactly the instruction that this is giving to you. I'll give you my best help in doing that I want you to do good. I want you to make a lot of sales. I want you to be productive. I don't want you to be complacent. Don't be complacent. It says in Romans 13 and verse 1, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God. Now, I believe that this has been misinterpreted in a number of ways. One, to mean that everybody that's in a leadership position is there because God put them there. I don't believe that. Now, you can believe it. I don't care. I mean, we could argue, I don't believe it. Because I don't care. I don't think God really cares who is in the position of dog catcher in Pima County. I don't think that's an important issue. Maybe if you've got a lost dog, it's important. And if somebody picks up your dog and takes it to the pound and sells it, or worse, you know, euthanizes it, maybe that's a bad thing. But there is no authority except for God. God allows men to be in positions. God has given the authority to man in this world. It began as soon as governments began to evolve, Genesis 10. There's a scripture in the early chapters of Genesis that show that God requires blood for murder. You know, it shows God's involvement to some degree in the governors or the rulers of this world, and expects certain things to happen. So authorities are there because God allows it to be there. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. But there is a caveat to that. Some have interpreted this to mean, hey, whatever the government tells you to do, you better do it. You better do it no matter what, because otherwise you're going to be accountable to God. Is that the case? I mean, taking to its ridiculous extreme, I guess some people could interpret the passage in that particular way. Now, make no doubt about it. God allows authorities to govern. God doesn't appoint every leader in history, but from the time of Genesis 9 and 10, he divided the nations. He allowed individual governments to arise. A better English word for the Greek word here is to establish. God established the ability for man to rule over himself. But for some, Paul's admonition seems to indicate that we should not resist these authorities because God appointed them. So what does it mean? Are we obligated as Christians to do whatever they tell us to do, no matter what, because God put them there? There's a caveat, and unfortunately, people sometimes don't read past the first verse. In verse 3, here's the caveat. Rulers are not a terror to good works. That means that if you are obeying a law in laws in society, they shouldn't be terrified. There shouldn't be terrifying to you. They shouldn't lock you up for doing good. Okay? They are for evil, but to evil. They're not a terror to good works. That's not their purpose. They're terror to evildoers, bad people, bad actors, people that break the law, people that endanger the lives of other people. Do you want to be unafraid of authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. As long as those conditions are met, all is well. All is good. God has allowed that authority to be there. As long as they're performing that function in society, then yes, you should be obedient to them. If they're a terror to evil actors and bad people. But if you do evil, be afraid. Be afraid, yeah, absolutely. God has appointed them and allowed them or established authority of man so that they're going to be bad to you. If you break the law, if you murder, steal, cheat, lie, and you cause somebody harm. For he does not bear the sword in vain. In such a case, as long as those narrow requirements are met, he is God's minister. And this is consistent throughout all of the passages in which Paul or others speak about governmental authority. Do you realize that? You're not obligated to obey somebody that tells you to break the law, just to make it very clear and very, very plain. So if you break this passage down, just one, we'll go to others. If you break this down, authorities are to be a ruler of terror to evil works. Paul said Christians are to do good. The ruler is God's minister to you for good. He is an avenger to execute wrath on those who practice evil. And in such a case, man, government authorities are great when they perform that function. The authorities or the establishment that God has allowed are intended to protect us from evil. And I realize that in the Roman Empire, you had despots at the time of Paul's writing. But Paul wasn't telling Christians to obey Nero and go help set the city of Rome on fire, for instance, to make a ridiculous example. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. Now, testing is the overall arching first point here, but I wanted to clarify this aspect of the government in our lives. Yes, you pay your taxes, you're a good citizen, you do all that, the authorities tell you to do that, and Christ said to do that too, so you do it, okay? So, 1 Peter 2 and verse 13 says, "Therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme." We should be subject to decrees or laws. Okay, that's pretty plain. In verse 14, it says, "Or to governors, as to those who are sent by him, for what purpose?" It's consistent exactly with what Paul said. Peter and Paul agreed. "For the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good." See how consistent it was? The instruction of the Bible is not carte blanche, do whatever the government tells you to do, you know, just mindlessly, you know, like a sheep, do whatever. You have to test. You have to test. "For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as the bondservants of God." So you can see that these injunctions are not directives for Christians to blindly submit. And it may not be an issue right now. It may not be an issue right at the very moment that we're speaking of. But what if it does become an issue? What if you are told to do something that in your conscience you know is against God? Well, do you realize that we've had over a year, 16 months, of potential conditioning to do what is for the greater good, which is a socialist concept, a communist concept, actually at its very heart. One for all for one, yada, yada, yada. Your individual liberties being challenged, taken away. The government says, okay, we got to obey the government. So no, this is not what Paul's saying. So you have to use your discernment and you have to understand and test. How do you do it? Show you in a second. But these clearly are not directives for Christians to submit blindly to whimsical mandates and just say, okay, they know better than us. I have given sermons on several occasions in this congregation and in our congregations elsewhere that the experts who lay down the law, you know, they don't have law, they don't have codified law. The experts are often wrong. When I was growing up as a kid in the 70s, you know what they told us was going to happen? The whole world was going to freeze in 20 years. You know, we're going to be living because of what we're doing to the environment. It was going to get cold, baby. It was going to get so cold. The scientists, the experts, the people in the know. We are harming the planet so badly that the whole ice age is going to be ushered in because we're traveling around in automobiles and jets and doing all these and having factories, and we shouldn't do this stuff. And guess what? In 20 years, it wasn't freezing in Tucson, Arizona. There weren't snow caps. Well, maybe there were snow caps on the Catalinas at times, but there weren't. The whole desert wasn't covered with ice like they told us it was going to. And they did. They told us it was going to be. You really have to understand, okay, experts, they really write all the time? Maybe not. These instructions are an admonition to Christians of any area to be obedient to the law and the order that is in society. Because the authorities are supposed to be there to protect us from evil. Most of your lives, the authority of the government has been there for the most part. Now, it's not perfect, right? United States is not perfect, not more perfect than some other areas. It has been there. It has protected you. You know, legal system is a mess sometimes. And yes, the rich people do get better justice because they can hire better lawyers and they can get, you know, but at least if you can't afford a lawyer to defend yourself in court, a bad lawyer will be given to you. You'll have a bad person representing you that was last in law school, that went to a law school you never heard of or whatever. I'm just kidding to any attorneys, but they do fill a purpose in life. But I'm just saying it's not perfect, right? You know that. But at least it's better than a lot of other places in the United States. But the authorities are there to protect us from evil or lawlessness, not to force us to bend to their will when it becomes tyrannical or oppressive. We obey God rather than men, Acts 5:32, right? So, not Peter, not Paul, they didn't give instructions to Christians of the first century that implied that whatever they tell you to do, you better do it, because if you don't, then you're disobedient to God. No, because sometimes these people are liars. Okay, oh, Buchanan said that politicians sometimes are liars. Leaders are sometimes liars. Look, we know this. Some of the edicts and mandates are built on such a mountain of lies that you can't believe it. And it's been going on for a long time, by the way. So both of these apostles of God were instructing members of the church of God how to love God, to follow God, to keep his commandments, to do good in their towns, in their communities, to be law-abiding citizens. And if they needed help, as the examples in the book of Acts with the life of Paul show, that he lawfully appealed to the order of his Roman citizenship because that was an advantage that he had, and everybody, okay, we got to let this guy go. We can't do it. You know, it carried weight. So I'm not talking about anything maybe that you've been told to do during the past pandemic or 16 months, even though, quite honestly, some of them have been really stupid and dumb. Not going to mention what they are. But we have gotten into such a habit of compliance. How hard will the next set of things that you're told to do be? Oh, everything's, people are going to ball games. You can even shop at Trader Joe's without wearing a mask if you want to. In the most liberal of all stores, and even Costco, not forcing you to do it. But what if they tighten down again the restrictions, because now there's the Delta, there'll probably be the Alpha, the Omega variant that's going to come out. There'll be some scary Theta name that they'll attach. I mean, I think we are in for a round of continual viruses because they found that works. I'm not going to go into the stats, okay? More people have died as a result of lockdowns all over the world than attributable to a virus. Guarantee you. Do the research. Except, by the way, you've got your corporate entities that also are liars. You've got your corporate entities that control the flow of information along with a compliant news media. I could go on and on with that. But the point is, you have got to have a gut. You know what? You mean your instinct, right? You have got to have that so attuned to the Holy Spirit of God that that is what you trust. And that is how you evaluate. Not by blindly following. I mean, when I was a kid, what we were taught in the 50s and the 60s was to think critically. And maybe they went overboard at that time, but the one thing that they did to us in school was they taught us to question, and think, and even be skeptical. And that doesn't happen that often now, but you need to do that as a Christian. You really do. So both these men were telling the church at that time to obey the law. And that's why God allows governmental authorities, and that's why he established those, so that they would punish evildoers. It hasn't been perfect, obviously. So how do you test? Isaiah 8:20, if they don't speak according to the law or the prophets, then you know they're liars. You may still have to obey if it doesn't, you know, disobey God's law. Okay, so I'm not telling you to flout authority or to reject, not pay your taxes, or do something silly like that. Please understand, you may be required to do things that are uncomfortable and that you don't really want to do and you think are ridiculous, but if they don't break God's law, you may have to do them. But you have to test, and you have to understand, okay, is this really coming from God? No. Would God do that? And the same thing is true in evaluating all those leaders. Now, in the church, here's a problem that we have had in the church. I'm going to be very frank and very blunt with you about this. We have had a problem in the church of knowing that we've got the righteous church of God people, which is us, right? And then we've got this evil, horrible, wretched world out there, and everything there is bad. So it's either black or it's white. Or wait a minute, the church people, the bad government was over here. So this black and the white, the spiritually pure people like us, we're over here. That's not the way it works. What I'm saying is that sometimes our members have assigned moral equivalency to everything over here that is in the nasty world. So it's all bad. All leaders are bad. You know, and this goes back to, you know, a lot of different things that we have been brought up with in the church. But that's not how the Bible teaches you to think or to think critically. You cannot assign moral equivalency to this leader here and that leader here. And I could name names because this one is far more evil and this one wants good to be done. But because it's politics, we in the church sometimes, I'm not saying in every instance, we have been taught assign a moral equivalency. It's all bad. It's all wrong. And so we automatically judge everyone that's in the political sphere as being evil. And so it doesn't matter what they tell you, it's all bad. No, that you can look for yourself. You'll find out that there are some people that actually believe in law. So you apply the same principle of Isaiah 8:20. If they speak according to the law and the prophets, even if they don't know the law and the prophets, but if they speak according to rational judgment and righteousness, you can't assign that person the same way that you assign somebody that wants to see cities burned down and wants to put people in jail for no good reason just because they oppose you. That's not truth, justice in the American way, and Superman would not approve. Okay. Along with testing, subpoint B or A, take stock, take inventory. Every week in my work, down here on Speedway in Pantano, there's a storage unit group of storage units just to the west. Some of you know where it is. On the north side of the street, I had a storage unit there when I worked. That's where I kept all my samples. Keeping your samples straight is kind of like an obligation that you got these hundreds of examples, and you've got to, by governmental degree, which I think all this is good, by the way, it doesn't violate anything of my conscience, but as soon as I got into the industry, that's when they made you do sample counts, and you had to reconcile, and it's a good thing. I mean, subject to $50,000 fines, and on a personal level, and billions of dollars some companies have been assigned because of wrong use of samples. Our samples of drugs, you know, from us to the doctor, they go from us to the doctor, okay? And the doctor signs for them. And that, when I first came into the industry, that's when that first started. All of that first started. And it's a mountain of paperwork. But every week I would do a sample inventory to make sure everything lined up in the computer as to what I had in the physical inventory and that sort of thing. So this is where I'm asking you to look now in your own life. Take a spiritual inventory. You know, test yourself, in other words. And it's brought out in the Olivet Prophecy. Actually, I didn't know this until I looked in it, but it appears to be the magic number 7 times. Watch. Let's go to Mark chapter 13. I said watch. No pun intended, because that's the catchword. That's the word here. Matthew 13. Mark, pardon me, sorry. See? Just testing you to see if you're paying attention. I don't know why I said that. Okay. Matthew 13 and verse 9. Mark, I'm sorry. I don't know. It's in my head, okay? Because normally when I think of the Olivet Prophecy, I'm thinking of Matthew. So disregard what I'm saying. Let's fold it up. Let's have lunch. No, we'll continue. Mark, so sorry. Wow. If I didn't have my family here, I'd be really embarrassed. Kind of embarrassed already, but okay. I'll get over it. Verse 9 of Mark 13. But watch out for yourselves. Watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils. You will be beaten in the synagogues. You'll be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony to them. And that happened, as you know, in looking at the history of the New Testament church. That happened to the disciples and the apostles. And certainly we have record of it happening to the Apostle Paul. And it probably happened to all of them as well. Be careful about yourselves. Watch. Watch was the word. In Mark 13 and verse 33, I organized these so you could have them all together in one, you know, this book, and this book. Mark 13 and verse 33, it says, take heed, watch, and pray. Be spiritually vigilant. I don't think we need to just delve into how to do that. I think you know how to do that. You've been around for a long time. You are to watch and pray, for you do not know when the time is. You do not know when the time is. I may forget this. So I'm going to interject it now. Discussing with a colleague some things on Bible prophecy, and they said, I'll just use the ubiquitous they as a pronoun. Not that they identify with a they, but anyway. The person said, we've been saying these things for 50 years. I said, no, we've been saying them for 70 and 80, because it goes back to the 30s when Mr. Armstrong began his ministry. But Christ never said in his instruction on the Olivet Prophecy, this only applies just before I get here. Don't pay any attention to it until the time comes, about 3.5 years out. It's an instruction for the entire church. I felt like saying to the person, yeah, we've been saying this for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. Were you paying attention? Because the idea was, it almost made me afraid. It almost made me afraid for them, in a sense, because I'm thinking, this is what 2 Peter says. My Lord delays his coming, or that where's the promise of his coming, as it says in 2 Peter. This is the instruction is not given just so that the people that, you know, if we happen to survive to the return of Jesus Christ, this is for the real now, you, me, everybody, 50, 60, 80 years ago. Because the instruction is meant for all of us in the church. So watch and pray. That's your duty. That's your job one. Verse 34, it says, it's like a man going to a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each of his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch. You're the doorkeeper. Your job is to watch, to be alert, to be spiritually alert, to test, to watch, to pray. That's your job. It's on you. Verse 35, watch therefore. This just springs out at you. If you're looking for it, it just kind of jumps out. Watch, watch, watch. You, at all times, doesn't matter when. And in verse 37, and what I say to you, I say to all, watch. It's like that's one of the most important things of the Olivet prophecy, along with the many times it talks about deception, 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 deception. Is one of the main hallmarks of the signs that would precede. So you better watch, or else you get caught unaware. All right, Luke 21. And this again is the Olivet prophecy, but Luke is adding a few things that are not mentioned in Mark. Luke 21, and in verse 34... again, this comes up. So remember, these are the same instances, but different authors are writing about the same thing, but they're adding. Now we're seeing an additive comments from different authors. In verse 34, it says, but take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighted down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass. So take heed to yourselves. Watch out for the cares of this life. Could drag you away. Yes, they can. Just the normal everyday things, slippage, little by little by little, slipping away, and then you're gone. Not paying attention on a daily basis. And then finally, in Matthew 25, and I think sometimes we miss this because on the Mount of Olives, the disciples asked Jesus about the things that would come before the end of the age, and chapter 24 and the chapters we've already covered are all a part of the Olivet prophecy by different authors. But we sometimes forget that Matthew 25 is a part of the Olivet prophecy too. So over into the parable of the virgins, in verse 13, we read, watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man comes. That's seven times during the Olivet prophecy that I can find that Christ admonished his disciples and all of us to watch. So whatever the time frame is, keep watching. It's right now. And the next part of this parable talks about the lamps of the unwise virgins. And I'm not saying that our traditional explanation of what the oil in the lamps means is wrong, because traditionally we have said that oil is the representation of God's Holy Spirit. But let me just throw this out, something that Hugh, came up with in his study. Oil doesn't always have to represent the Holy Spirit. Okay? Now, do you need the Holy Spirit? Yes, nobody's arguing that. But think this through. What is the purpose of a light? In the darkness. In the world. The world is represented as darkness. Five wise virgins, five foolish, five had light, five didn't have light. Well, they didn't have oil. But in the wedding, in the wedding ceremony like this, to be able to go out and meet the bridegroom, they'd have these huge containers of oil. They would be on a pole and mounted, and they'd be lit. And that's how you would go out. I mean, there was a whole ceremony. I think Mr. Tanner's given a good sermon on that. You can ask him about it, and you can go through that. And the whole, very good to understand the ceremony that took place at that time. I don't have time to go into that. But the main thing is, if you didn't have light, you couldn't go out. Now, I know that you need oil, but the wise say what? They say, go buy oil. We can't give you our oil. You got to buy it. Well, you can't buy the Holy Spirit, because Simon Magus proved that. It's not for sale. So I kind of am leaning in that direction, that this doesn't represent the Holy Spirit at all. Now, it could in a, you know, kind of an obscure way. But what is needed is light. In verse 26, what does it say? What is the admonition to those virgins? Christ says, but his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant. He became complacent, rested on his laurels. You knew that I reap where I've not sown and gather where I've not scattered seed. Oh, really? That's not what Christ does. But you don't have to be a victim of sudden destruction if you're constantly watching. If you're constantly watching. So why is light important? This is the alternative explanation. What does light mean? The light, you're supposed to have light. The virgins all had to have light. What did they not do? Matthew 5, and I'm just going to give you an alternate, you know, look, we can argue about this, I guess we can talk about this, but leaven doesn't always mean sin in the Bible. Sometimes it's represented as a good thing. You know, leaven in the two loaves of Pentecost, it shows that the both epochs of the church are, you know, the congregation of Israel filled with sin. They can still be there, that's fine. They do have sin, they do have leaven present, that's fine, that's... But Matthew 5 and verse 13 says, you are the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? Verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, because then it would defeat the purpose of the light, right? You don't cover up a light with a basket, because then there's no light. But as members of God's church, we are representative of light. And so what does light represent? It's talking about your good works, your good behavior. Verse 16, let your light shine, so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, we all know that you can't save yourself by works, but we all know that good works are required. So I'm just throwing out to you that along with Romans chapter 2 and verse 19, Romans 2 and verse 19, indicate that what Christ is really speaking about is not neglecting your role and obligation as a Christian to have good works. In verse 19 it says, or verse, 219, and we are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind and a light to those who are in darkness. How could they be that way if they didn't have the right kind of behavior? Also, 1 John 1 and verse 7. Then we're going to move on to the last point, or last little bit that I have for you. 1 John 1, 7. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. So by light, by behavior, by our determination to do good, to good works. We have this cycle of being in contact with God continually. So where do you stand? Take inventory. Now, finally, I'm going to try to bring this into the barn now. Revelation chapter 2. Now, if some of you actually have seen this before and you didn't tell me about it, then shame on you. Shame on you. But I want to read just a little bit about each of these seven churches. And I'm not sure that I'm at the right conclusion, but it'll be food for thought for you. Okay? It kind of ties in a little bit. Revelation chapter 2, and we're going to do this rapid fire. We're going to go through all seven churches real quick. Just one little comment here, okay? Revelation 2 and verse 1, it says, to the angel of the church of Ephesus. Right. Okay, now let's go to the next one. Ephesus, the first era. Verse 8, to the angel of the church in Smyrna. Right. Okay, down to verse 12. And to the angel of the church in Pergamos, write. Now, going on, verse 18, to the angel of the church in Thyatira, write. And then to chapter 3 and verse 1, to the angel of the church in Sardis, write. And then over on to verse 7, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write. And then finally, verse 14, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans, write. Do you notice anything different about a couple of those verses? Shame on you if you didn't tell me about this, but I just noticed it, and I'm sorry that I just noticed it. It's so funny. You can read through something, and you can kind of gloss over it forever. I think it may have some meaning, though. This one little thing. Five of these churches, the five in the middle, on the bookends, Ephesus and Laodicea, it's the church of Ephesus, the church of the Laodiceans. But all the rest are specific to that geographical area. Now, what could that possibly mean? Now, I do believe, I've given a sermon on the seven churches, and you can type in on the UCG website, you can find all seven of those sermons, or probably eight sermons altogether. A couple of years ago, back in 2018, I gave a whole series, not all at once, but through a period of 6 or 7 months. And you can just type in the church name and me as the author, and in the search engine, it'll find that what you're looking for. And I was fascinated by what I discovered. I was really fascinated, but I missed this during that study. But it is interesting to me that at the end of the age of the Ephesian era, end of the Ephesian era, better way of putting it, John was writing. That era was nearly past at the time of his writing in the 90s AD. So the work of that group, in which Christ said, you know, recapture your first love, which I believe was the preaching of the gospel. And as you can see what happened during the 60 years from Christ's death to 90 AD, so to speak, rough framework of chronology, you can see that it was almost past. And those who were still alive, they still needed to have the zeal and desire, the effort to do the work. So I believe that that's the reason that of Ephesus is mentioned in the first part. All the rest are specific geographic locations, and they would not unfold yet at the time of John's writing. They would unfold later on through history. And the one that I was, the church era that I was most admirous of, except for the Philadelphian era, was Thyatira, because those people knew who they were. Their emblem, the seal of the Waldensians, points to seven stars and points to the fourth one, and I really believe that they knew who they were. But you can find more about it if you look up that particular sermon. But the on the other end of the scale, it says, of, if you read it here, it says in verse 14, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans. There's a lot of history about the Laodiceans. The area was wealthy. They were at the epicenter of the Roman Empire. They were self-sufficient. They rebuilt themselves apparently after numerous earthquakes. They were important for the mining of gold. They minted their own coins. They had sophisticated banks for the day. I mean, they were self-sufficient. They rebuilt themselves. They didn't depend on the Roman Empire. They were one of the highlights of the Roman Empire. One of the things that we have, I think, erroneously said through the years is that these people had drinking water that was full of minerals and lukewarm, and that's why Christ spits them out of their mouth. No. The Romans built an aqueduct from the south to Laodicea because they'd use huge quantities of water. They had drinking water there. They were in a fertile river valley. They had underground wells. They weren't drinking bad water. You ever drank bad water? I mean, in South Dakota, we had some friends in the church that lived out in the middle of the state, actually. And they had a well, but they had to have that water super filtered, or else you just couldn't drink it. And it would cause you problems if you drank it, even though it was not something that would kill you and didn't have bacteria in it. But, you know, without being... Anyway, that was the kind of water that they had. And it was hot water, too, underneath. Christ spits Laodicea out of his mouth. But they were rich. They were wealthy. They had this water from the aqueduct that the Romans built was not for the purpose of supplying drinking water. I'm convinced of that. Now, nobody else has verified that with me, but I'm convinced in doing my research that that is the purpose of it for the mining of gold and other minerals and for the production of wool, because that's what they were famous for. And for the dyeing of wool, apparently this mineral-laden water that they had was so good that it helped accentuate that color that they used to dye the wool. It's true. True story. But the lukewarmness in the attitude is something I think from a spiritual standpoint we can understand. And I do not believe, as some do, there's some of the other sister churches that we have, oh, that group is Laodicea and this group is Laodicea. No, I don't believe that. I believe that Laodicea is comprised of people who have, God still considers them his because he called them. But at some point, maybe in the future or maybe in the past, these folks have left behind the truth. And they're woken up during the Great Tribulation. Because you'll notice that this church is still called God's church. It doesn't have to be an organization. They don't even have to be keeping the Sabbath anymore. And they know that, you know, maybe you probably know some people that are like this. And I hope that none of us ever get to that position to where we are neglectful of the things that we know. But I think that that explains that Laodicea is not an era that is typical of all the others, to where you could point to a group like the Waldensians or the Paulicians or the Henricians or whoever throughout history and say, oh, that was God's people. They may not even be, but you'll notice that Christ says that he loves them, he rebukes them, he chastens them, and there's a possibility they could overcome. Well, what would stand in the way of overcoming? Not testing, not watching, not being diligent. Because if you're the ones who don't think you need God anymore and you don't need to be here, you don't need to be around God's people, you don't need to be a part of an organization, you're going to stop doing the things that made you different when you were first called. And gradually, little by little, you just kind of fade away. And I've known a lot of people like that. And whether they are in the church in God's eyes or whether he called them or not, that is up to him. But if you get to that point, you know, if you ever get to that point, then you're wretched, poor, blind, and naked, and you don't even know it. You're spiritually unaware. You're spiritually asleep. And that's what Christ admonishes us not to do, to wake up and to perform God's commands, which set us apart from the world around us. So, okay, right now, all of you, get out of my car. Get out. You walk up to the sales manager, and you buy yourself a brand new Cadillac, a Mercedes, or a Dodge, or whatever. But seriously, brethren, let's take stock, let's take inventory, and continue to watch.